Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2010. Lecture 1, delivered on August 23, 2010. The title of this lecture is Introduction to the Discipline.
Today, Introduction to the Discipline. This class is technically called Business Finance. The focus of this class will be on managerial finance, management finance, financial management, whatever you want to call it. Let me break down finance into three specific subcategories. There is financial management, analysis of projects, analysis of financial statements, the basics. And then there is also institutions, financial institutions, which would have to do with money in banking, which is often taught in economics or in finance, and also all the different kinds of financial intermediaries out there that put together surplus economic units with deficit economic units. And then there is the world of investments. Now, I'll touch into the world of financial institutions. Necessarily, I have to. I will also touch into the world of investments. Necessarily, I'll have to. The focus, however, will keep reverting back to the core of financial management. But along the way, you will hear a lot, well, I don't know of a lot, but you will hear about the other disciplines within finance. Now, finance itself, the book has this textbook, has a standard routine that finance is essentially a combination of economics and accounting, which makes me feel dirty. The accounting part does. Accounting, we have to use accounting data, but we are fundamentally a type of economist. And that's why you have someone like me who is a financial economist teach you. Thank God you've got the best financial economist that ever walked the earth. And the best teacher, too. But that's another story entirely. Now, the story of finance is the story of primarily economics blended with some accounting. But I caution you that even though we will use accounting statements in this class, this is by no means an accounting course. And we'll have a chapter on accounting, but that's just so that we can make sure that you are up to speed on just the basics of what I mean by the financial statements, how we read the financial statements. By no means will you be learning how to do debits and credits or stuff like that in this class. We will do a lot more in the realm of economics. As I told you before the podcast started, I am an economist, and I teach economics, and I write on economics, and I will bring that to bear in this class. It is absolutely imperative that you know your economics. Unfortunately, I suspect that any economics you took, you flushed right out of your minds as soon as that course was over. Would that be fair to say? Okay, good. Good, good. Well, fortunately for you, I will give you the economics again. I want to go through a couple of basics about economics first and foremost. I want you to tell me something. Sir, what is opportunity cost? If you don't know, just say, I don't know. That's okay. It is one of the most important concepts in economics. It is also one of the most important concepts in finance, too. In fact, does anyone know what opportunity cost is? Would you like to take a stab? Work it.
It's the cost of the choice that you didn't make.
The choice? There's a lot of choices.
Well, the choice that you made gives you one benefit. The choice that you could have made.
The choices.
Makes a difference.
Okay, choices. Well, there are a lot of choices. I could have been here. You could have been here. Or you could have been working at McDonald's for $10, in your case, $6 an hour. So, no, I've... Or you could have gone to, you could be playing World of Warcraft. Or you could be surfing for porn. Or you could be a male model opposite Justin Bieber. Or Keisha. Excuse me. You know, when you eat, you say nom, nom, nom. When you say Keisha, you say mon, 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 because it's coming the other way. Okay. Sorry. Okay, you see, it's not just the choice you gave up. It's the best alternative you surrendered. Opportunity cost is the cost of the best foregone alternative. Opportunity cost is the cost of the best foregone alternative. So when you do anything, you give up the value of the best foregone alternative. You see, that's not accounting. Accounting, by its rules, needs paper, needs documentation. But an opportunity cost is never seen. You never see money come out of your pocket. You never see money come into your pocket from an opportunity cost, but it is there. Okay, let's take it this way. Woman, you finish your degree at this fine institution. We've made arrangements for you. You're going to get a job at State Barn. $60,000 a year. And you just disappear. And I'm sitting in my office. And in late January, 2 years from now, all of a sudden, you show up at my office door. Professor C, I lived the dream. What? I started my own donut shop. Wait, what? Weren't you the one we arranged to get the job at State Barn? You know? Yes, but I felt it since I was a child. I wanted to have a donut shop. And you know what? I've had my first full year in business. My bookkeeper just came to me and showed me my profit and loss statement. And there it was. I made a profit of $20,000. My revenues were $90,000. My expenses were $70,000. Can you believe it? My first full year in business, I made $20,000 in profit. What do you think of that, Professor C? You know what I'll say to you? Burn it to the ground. Oh, bring the donuts here first. To quote again Frank from Donnie Darko, burn it to the ground. You say, wait, what? Why? I made $20,000. No, you lost $40,000. Do you understand that? The accountant can't do that for you, but I can. $40,000 is what you lost. You made an economic profit of negative $40,000. Because you could have made $60,000. Instead, you made $20,000. You lost. And I will tell you this, that human rationality ensures that Clueville will call you on the phone, maybe sooner, maybe later, and you will realize that this is not the life to live. You will finally realize that you are making $20,000 when you could have been making $60,000, and you will say what every intellectual sooner or later says, FTS. Fancy that scenario. You see what's going on here? Eventually, you'll do the rational thing. You will walk away. And I can tell you right now, I've run businesses, into the ground, mind you, but I've run businesses, and I didn't make as much as I could have doing something else. I eventually walk away, sometimes right away, sometimes later. When I'm sitting there in my office, and I am just joyful that I've made enough so that I can go over to Denny's and have a meal. It was decent. It was a grand slam, but... I will react to the economics, not to the accounting. I will react to the economics. That's why you will see companies post, we made a profit of $16 million in the last quarter, and the stock goes through the toilet, out into the sewage system via the hole in the pipe. Why? Because based upon the risk the investors were bearing in putting money into that company and riding it, that wasn't enough. So they punish the stock. They sell it off, get out of the investment. That's the reality of finance. We can't work in the world of accounting. All we can do is sort of look at those numbers and, well, you know, that's kind of interesting, but that's really not how life works. Talk to me. Go ahead. No, it includes more than opportunity cost. But it doesn't, an opportunity cost is the dominant cost. It is the dominant cost. In fact, and by rules they have to, because they have to have documentation. They have to have documentation of what they're doing. You cannot work in a world where you say, well, I feel that this person could have made. But inside of us, we do know we could have done better. And in that business, that donut shop, you could have done better. And eventually that will come through and you will react to that. Just like we see in the financial world all the time. It's not, let me step to this here just really briefly. It's almost, I don't want to get into philosophy. People like me in business and economics, we're not philosophers unless we're drunk. It's this difference between the desired and the desirable, what we say and what we do. We say things all the time, the ideals of obeying the law, the ideals of reacting to things that we have learned and what we know is culturally acceptable, but that's completely different from what we do. That's why in the world of finance, in the world of economics, we can't care about what polls say, what surveys say. That's what people say they say. What we do is we have to assume people are rational. And the only thing that binds rationality is information and resources. But given that our information, our resources, and our time are limited within those limits, we're going to do what is in our self-interest. And that's something we have to assume in our kind of work. So let me take another example. And interestingly enough, this is opportunity cost, but it's an opportunity cost shining from a different point of view. So when we're talking about the opportunity cost, I want to make sure we understand it in an expanded way. I'm looking around this room. Oh, I see who I want to talk to about this. Yeah, you're the guy. You. You are living the dream. You have opened your own little gas station. You have changed your name to Bud so that you can wear a shirt with a circle that says Bud. You've bought yourself a pair of low-riding pants so when you bend over to change a tire, your crack shows. And you are doing gasoline. I'm Bud. I'll sell gasoline. Uh-huh. I mean, what? Wait, what? You've pulled your latest haul of gasoline, 10,000 gallons, you brought in at $2.50 a gallon. So you've spent $25,000 on this load of gasoline. Now, you look around, you walk outside, and you look at the prevailing price on the competitors, and it looks like it's running, the prevailing is around $2.75 in that area, and you figure at that price you can sell your load of gasoline. Now, that's not collusion, that's just price transparency, which is an excellent thing. So you say, well, okay, I'll do a markup of 25 cents per gallon. And I will charge $2.75 a gallon for my gas, okay? So you've changed the sign, and you go back into your little kiosk thing, and you sit down with your black and white television to watch real news, Fox. Yeah, okay. And all of a sudden you see running across the screen, Israel attacks Iran. Iran mines the Strait of Hormuz. One U.S. aircraft carrier has been dropped in the Persian Gulf. Two supertankers are ablaze as they try to escape down the Strait of Hormuz. Silkworm missiles have brought down two American destroyers, and a second round of nuclear explosions has been reported in Tehran and Basra. Basra? That's Iraq. Wait a minute. They were supposed to be like 2 years away from it's fun all over the place. And you suddenly realize, you go outside and you look around, you see that the tanker had not gotten to your competitor's stations yet. So by the time it got to their stations, that tanker was selling its loads of gas at $7.50. They were marking up 25 cents. So all of your competitors are now selling their loads of gas at $7.75. That's unbelievable. Now, you look at their prices on their signs, you look at the price on your sign. Well, you got your gas at $2.50. What are you going to do with your sign? You going to leave it, or are you going to change it to prevail? Anyone want to help out here? What would you say? Are you saying mark it up? Oh, you greedy sons of bitches. No, Bud, you're a fine, upstanding Presbyterian. You say, no, I got that gas at $2.50. I'm going to sell it at $2.75. I'd be ripping my customers off. My customers love me. I can be very friendly. Yes, I can. That was an old, before your time. Anyway. You know what? You hold your price at $2.50. What's going to happen when you have to buy your next load of gas? That's right. You see, historical cost is absolutely irrelevant. All that matters is replacement cost. All that matters is replacement cost. Replacement cost. Never historical cost. You see why accounting is dangerous for us? Because accounting is historical cost. We do not react to the past unless it's right there in our faces beating our asses. We react to the future, what we expect, our expectations, what it will cost to replace it. Well, I'm sure the price of gas will go back down by the time I get my next load. Yeah, right. So you see, and here's the other thing about it. Well, I feel bad. I'm screwing my customers. You know what? You keep your price at $2.75, your customer's going to wipe out your gas. You're going to go out of business, and they're not going to even remember what your name was, even though you had it sewn into a special nice patch. They'll just go right on beyond you and start buying the gas at $7.75. That's the reality of it. Their loyalty is zip. So they'll wipe out your great bargain on gas, and then they'll just move on to the next gas station that's still open once yours closes. That's the reality of it out there. Here's the rule. Never assume your opponent's intentions, only your opponent's capabilities. So that's another part of it. You see, the opportunity cost of that gas is $7.50. Not, but that's another window on that same idea, though. So when you probe me about the opportunity cost, it gives me the chance to say, well, there are all these different ways that you can see opportunity cost. Giving up one thing for another, replacement cost versus historical cost, all of those are part of the rationality that we have to have, and we have to assume this kind of rationality in finance. Okay, enough of that part of it. Now, I made a mention a couple of times in the last few minutes, and I want to key on this. I'm going to be covering some economics basics, fundamentals that I need for finance. One of them is this idea of rationality. I'm going to assume that everyone in the world is rational. Our rationality is bounded. It's bounded by our resources available to us. including the most important ones, information and time. But other than that, people are not irrational. They base their behaviors on what is best for them. Let's take it this way. Madam, I have 2 grades left, and I have you and you as my 2 students I need to give a grade to. I've got an A and an F. Well, I happen to see you first, and you're over there. Oh, my ass is dead. He's giving it to her. Which one do you want, the A or the F? It's your call. Well, of course you do. At the end of the day, I've got to assume that you are greedy, that you are going to drive for your own self-interest. You are not going to want to hold hands and sing Kumbaya. You are not going to want to live in the woods and turn blue and say, hey, well. You are going to be a greedy person. You are going to act in your interest, your own self-interest. You're rational. Now, rationality is bounded. We make mistakes. Have you ever heard of something called the Darwin Awards? It's an award that is given to people who have done humanity the greatest favor by taking themselves out of the gene pool. And therefore, they don't pass their stupid genes along to anyone else. To give you an idea of the Darwin Awards, one of the winners some years back was a fellow. He and his friends had gone into an abandoned mine in West Virginia. That's your clue. There is a qualifier for a Darwin Award, West Virginia. They went into the mine and they found blasting caps. And being the kind who had their idea of a party was a case of beer and something that makes noise, they took the blasting caps, they got drunk, and they were putting blasting caps into a giant aquarium of water, and they were trying to hook electrodes to them to cause them to go off, and they just wouldn't. Well, one of the men who was particularly drunk off his ass, he did something. He reached in and he took one of the blasting caps and he put it into his mouth. Now, here's where usually a funeral follows. He said, watch this. And he chomped down on the blasting cap, and sure enough, it actually did go off. Now, technically, he didn't win because he lived, although he lost all of his teeth, which probably makes him even more of an attractive mate in West Virginia. But was this guy irrational? No. He just didn't know. The consequences, now you say, well, he should have. Well, he was drunk, and he was dumb. But he just didn't know. Well, I saw that person have an accident. That person could have swerved that way. The person didn't have the time to swerve. You see, if we have more time, more resources, we can oftentimes make a better decision. But under the constraints of our time and the information available to us, we're still rational. We talk about young people. Well, they're so damn dumb. They just haven't lived enough of life to see all the nuances and the curves it can throw. And that's why you become more conservative as you get older. Although I don't care. That doesn't explain why people become teabaggers, tea party members, but that's another story entirely. I'm going to tell you a secret here, sir. You're going to die someday. It will hurt like hell, probably. It usually does. You'll bitch, and then you'll go away forever. Within the frame of that happy thought, trust me, I'm older than you. I see Mr. Death. You walk by a pane glass window and you see this shadow behind you. What the hell is that? Okay, but you see, within the frame of that life, you have constraints. You've got to make those choices. Sometimes you're going to make them with what other people would say, well, that was irrational. But that's all the information you had. You don't make stupid decisions. You just make decisions based upon this frame of time. Life is short. I've got just this much time. In this situation, in this week, in this month, in this lifetime. So you have these limits on how much rationality you can put to bear on any kind of problem that is in front of you. Now, in the frame of that rationality and our assumption that people are greedy, we can cabin what we talk about here. I assume that the markets are brutally rational. If there is a mistake, it is a mistake of a defect of information that is available. That's why in the popular literature you see this word bubble all the time. Bubble is one of the stupidest ass words there is. It almost implies that there's some magical, mystical force causing prices to rise. Well, there's a bubble. Will you quit that? It's like, do any of you remember the Don Ho song, Tiny Bubbles in the Wine? We aren't that. Bubbles don't happen. Prices move up and they move down for reasons, and they're good reasons. You don't have markets say, oh, we're going to make the price too high today. That does not happen. So in the mid-1990s, when the Federal Reserve Chairman, Alan Greenspan, went before Congress and he said, the stock market has irrational exuberance, the man was off his rocker. There is no such thing as irrational exuberance in a financial market. Markets do what they do for a reason. The rationality, and when you're talking about billions of transactions, trillions of dollars flowing every day, yeah, sure, that's a place where irrationality is going to rule the day, not. Always assume that there is a reason, and that reason is based upon rational decision-making by individuals and by markets. Don't ever assume irrationality, and that would give you a window into just... You ask the question, if someone who is the Federal Reserve Chairman would say something like that, either the man has lost his mind or he has a hidden agenda. The answer to which that was, we will reveal as the course goes on. In just the next few lectures, we'll talk about the Federal Reserve and what was really going on and how that impacts on us in finance. What it means, what the Federal Reserve's decisions and actions are, what it means in finance. Now, as far as financial management goes, we are keenly interested in cash flow. That's our big thing, is cash flow. You see, you could make $100,000 a year. I'm sure you will. You're a very handsome stud. You'll get a good job. But suppose that you're starving to death today and your paycheck doesn't come in till the end of the month, which would be in 6 days, 7 days. You'll die before your money shows up. You see, what matters to you is not income, not wealth. Cash flow is what matters. Cash flow is what drives us in finance from day to day, week to week, month to month. You hear this talk about strategic planning? That's not our world. That's not what we do. We may talk about it. Well, my plan for the future is, well, actually you can talk about that, but what's your real plan for the future is, are you going to have food tonight? And maybe after you have food, are you going to have some butt? Okay? That's the reality of it. And in finance, we have to care about cash flow. Not financial statements, profit and loss, not income, not the wealth of the corporation, not retained earnings. There's really no such thing in reality as retained earnings. There is no account at a bank that says retained earnings. We can't draw retained earnings to finance a project. All that matters is cash flow to us in finance. Cash flow has three components. Component one, level. In other words, the size. Level of the cash flow. And that means what the valence is too, by the way. The valence, positive or negative. Here's something that you might want to write down. Positive is better than negative for cash flow. Real finance for real people. Okay. thought, well, I better write that down. No, obviously, positive would be better than negative if we're talking about cash flow. Okay, so first one is level. Second one is timing. Now, here's another thing. I could give you $1,000 today or $1,000 in 10 years. Which do you want? Well, it's still $1,000, isn't it? You're looking at me like, no. No, it's not. It isn't. Timing matters. Timing matters. As this course goes along, you'll see that we actually have a way, a unit conversion for time. It's a way, sort of like centimeters to inches and all that. It's actually the same thing, except it's a more detailed formula to convert dollars sometime in the future to dollars now, or dollars now to sometime in the future. It's just a unit conversion like metrics to English units or something like that. So we've got level, we've got timing. And the third, the biggie, is risk. Risk is a monster. 800-pound gorilla. I'm going to do something here. I'm not bothering the people up above enough. Sir, I got a dollar. I would like you to go up to the roof. We got an actual place where you can get out on the roof here and jump off the roof and hit pay dirt. And if you do it, I'll give you this dollar. Look, this is a real one. This isn't one of those I did on my high-quality Canon printer. This is a real one.
I believe you.
Okay, so let's go. Oh, you're afraid you're going to hurt yourself, maybe die. Well, you're right. It's like those people who go into haunted houses. Why do people, you open the door, the house says, don't! And they go in and they all get hacked up. We are rational. For a higher level of risk, we expect, not necessarily get, but we expect a higher return. The greater the risk taken, the greater the return expected. Again, we're not stupid. I would like you, madam, to lie down on the railroad tracks just outside on the west side of town. Just lie down. You spend the whole night on those tracks. And in the morning, I'll give you $10. $10. Well, yeah, a train might come like, man, man, ding, 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 ding. And we might have to clean you up with a spatula. But, you see, that's $10. You see, you're not getting enough. Now, if I said $100,000, you wouldn't have said no thanks as fast, would you? You might have checked the train schedules. You see, here's the deal. We won't do things unless we are going to have some kind of a reward for it. That's not necessary. I've got to be careful with you because in the old days, I would have said, we've got to get the money for it. There are other rewards, and we are finding out in experimental economics and finance, when we're actually experimenting with human behavior, that we had to modify some of our basic valuation understanding. Money isn't the only thing that motivates people. People will bear risk for things other than just pure money. In finance and in traditional economics, we have to say we use money as the metric of value. Okay, we just have to. But I do. I'm not denying that there are other things. You've seen on YouTube people do very stupid things just for the fame of it. No money. Just, I mean, movie Jackass comes to mind. So really there are other rewards other than money, pure money itself, that might be involved. But for our purposes, we'll use money as our sole metric evaluation. But if you are going to bear greater risk, you expect a higher reward. So when we say the first principle of finance, the greater the risk, the greater the expected return that must be provided. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return that must be provided. Now, notice that I said expected. There is no crystal ball. Tomorrow, a meteorite might hit the Earth and kill us all. Tomorrow, something might happen that would change everything. So we have to say expected, because we can't guarantee the future. That's what risk is about. We're taking a risk, expecting a higher reward. Some of you in here will be independent business people. Some of you will be. You will do that because you expect some extraordinary reward for the extraordinary risk that you will bear. Now, in this world, there are some people who are very risk averse, and there are some people who are not so risk averse. In finance, we play that. There are economic agents out there that like risk, that prefer it more than you do. They are there to take risk off your hands for a fee. You might be a very risk-averse person, and so you might be willing to trade off risk for a lower expected return. That's just how it works, and that's one of the most crucial aspects of finance. That's what makes financial world thrive, is different types, clientels for different levels of risk. Some of you are going to go out there and you're going to work for State Barn, or you're going to work for some company like that, go up to Chicago, work for a big firm. Others of you are going to take more risk and go out on your own or work for a small upstart. It's based upon your preference for risk. Now, so the three parts of cash flow, level, timing, and risk of the cash flow. That's what we care about, and much of what we do in this class is going to have to do with those three components interlocking and dancing with each other to give us the answers to the problems that we pose, the best answer we can get. And there are, again, are no certainties. Any answers we get in finance are the best we can do. And I put this to you, and I'll finish this up with that here in a minute, one last thought. But before I do that, I want to bring up the structure of a business organization. And I break that structure into three different types. There is the sole proprietorship. Now, a sole proprietorship is a one-person show, all at risk. You decide that you're going to start your own lawn mowing company, sir. You're going to drive a lawnmower and mow lawns. So, any money you make is all yours. Any costs you incur, they come out of your pocket. So if you're mowing a lawn and you accidentally mow some rich lady's poodle, she'll sue you. The poodle will too if the poodle lived. And I don't care if you say, I just gave the poodle a show dog trim. You mowed the poodle, so she can sue you. Not only can she sue you for your business's bank account, she can sue you for your truck, your lawnmower, and indeed your ass. You are all at risk. Everything you have, right there. So this sole proprietorship is the highest level of risk of a business organization. You get all of the money that's made, but you bear all of the risk if something goes wrong. All the bills come to you, personally. Now the second level is the partnership, where the risk is essentially, it's like a sole proprietorship, but the risk is shared by more than one person. But it's something, all the profit goes to the partners, but essentially, if something goes wrong, the partners are jointly and severally liable in that kind of a case. Now, there are different kinds of partnerships, and I don't want to get into that. That was a world, if you wanted to get into that, I teach business law sometimes, so we can get into that later in a course like that. But there are limited partnerships where some of the partners are all at risk and some of the partners have only limited liability. But just in general, a partnership is like a sole proprietorship, except that there's more than one person who is all at risk. And then there is the pinnacle of the business organization sense, the corporation. The corporation is a separate entity. Once the organizers have filed the articles of incorporation with the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation, notice that a corporation is a state animal, not a federal animal. But once the organizers of the corporation have filed the articles of incorporation with the Secretary of State of the State of Incorporation, and the Secretary of State has qualified those articles, notice there that the Secretary of State doesn't approve them. It merely qualifies them. Once the Secretary of State qualifies the corporation, that corporation becomes a legal entity under the law. It is a person. It has its legal obligations and it has its legal rights, a set of rights that are evolving and becoming large, expanded, especially under our extremely conservative Supreme Court, to the point now where corporations are recognized as having virtually the same speech rights as humans do, citizens do. So the corporation is not just a person under the law. It is evolving through time. And this has been a process that's been going on, especially since the mid-20th century. The corporation is becoming essentially the legal equivalent of a human. Will it ever be completely like a citizen? Maybe, maybe not. But the corporation, and once you have been, once a corporation has been qualified, it files on form SS, I better be careful about that, SS8, I think it is, for a federal employee identification number. That's essentially the same as a person being after birth getting a social security number. So this corporation is a legal entity. It has the rights and it has the obligations. But what that also means is that there becomes a wall separating the owners of the corporation from the corporation. The corporation is responsible for its own debts. But so the owners are not all at risk. They're at risk only to the extent of an investment that they make. They cannot have the corporate veil pierced unless they have really done a lot of wrong things. The corporate veil will stand. If the corporation goes into bankruptcy, that's it. The owners lose their equity stake, but the debt holders can't go through and go to the people. That's why in accounting, the fundamental equation of accounting is total assets equal total liabilities plus owner's equity. You see, in that equation there is a mathematical, indeed a virtually physical representation of the wall between the liabilities that belong to the corporation and the owner's equity. As a consequence of that, theoretically, the owners must be separate from the management of the corporation. They can't go in there and sniff around. There is the corporation and its operations. There are the owners and their personal lives. And the two cannot be intermingled. That's the corporate veil that exists. Given that, the corporation is a limiter on risk so that you are not all at risk as an owner of a corporation like you were at risk as as owning your own lawn business. It's a very different animal. It's a fundamentally different animal. In this course, we will deal exclusively with corporations. We will talk about, when I talk about finance. I will talk about it in the context of corporations, because in a sense, even though sole proprietorships are actually the largest by numbers, they're the most common in the United States and, in fact, in the world. And most of you actually have been sole proprietors. Most of you, almost every one of you, I would say, at some point has been a sole proprietor. You might not have known it, but you were. If you did babysitting, if you worked, did some work for someone, mowed a lawn for some money, you were a sole proprietor. So even though sole proprietorships are the most common organizational form of a business, it is the corporations that are what we focus on, because that is where the margin is as far as risk goes, because all the risk is contained within the corporation and cannot flow to the owners. Now, here's how this works in this class. You should read chapter 1 in the book for Wednesday. Go to my website, have a look around, see if there's something for you to do there. And then when we come back on Wednesday, we will begin this again, and I will finish up, tie up chapter 1, and then move on to chapter 2. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.